Welcome to the Barbara Schulte Show with host Barbara Schulte and producer Ben Self. The Barbara Schulte Show brings conversations, stories, and tips intended to power up a writer's potential for more success, fun, and the confidence to ride and live with grace, courage, and the grit to never give up.
In this episode, you'll meet Sandy Collier from Santa Maria, California. Sandy is one of the most accomplished and multi-talented people I know. She's a dear friend, and I'm honored to do clinics and retreats with her. And here's why. She is so bright. She does everything with dedication and excellence, from training horses and people to flying airplanes and life coaching. And you'll hear Sandy explain how she began her career in the three-day eventing English world until she discovered rein cow horse in the Western world, and she never looked back. She talks about what it's like to be a cow horse trainer and teach a horse to be confident in three separate events in a year and a half. We could also call Sandy Miss Resilient. No matter the number of joint replacements or surgeries, she's always found a way to use that time away from riding to create educational products or learn new skills like real estate or life coaching. Sandy is one unstoppable cowgirl, and I know you're going to love hearing what she has to say. Prepare to be inspired to reach for more than you ever thought you could accomplish.
So, hey, my friend.
Hey, Barb.
This is so much fun to be doing this.
I know.
We get to hang together a lot, and I'm just so happy that you're here. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah. Well, you just finished judging the Snaffle Bit.
I did. I did the marathon.
I know. I got these texts saying, they're working us really hard. So how was it?
It was awesome. It was really awesome. It was long, but the way, because they could extend the number of days, the length of the days were not as long mm-hmm. as they have been in the past at different events. Mm-hmm. When they get boxed in on both ends at, say, South Point, the days then have to become longer as they get more entries. Mm. This way, we didn't have to, you know, work until the wee hours, but 17 days is a long time to stay focused for, you know, 13-hour days.
So what did you think of the show?
It was pretty darn exciting. It was, I think, the quality of the horses and the quality of the training and the abilities of the people to show their horses has gone up geometrically, and it was fun to judge.
I was going to say, it was exciting to judge.
The finals was fun to judge, and the fact that, you know, Justin ran away with it, basically took a lot of pressure off. Like the winner was so clear mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. it was like, oh, phew.
Yeah, I'm sure that's a relief, right?
Yeah. When everybody has the 1, 2, 3, and 4 all on the same on their card, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, oh, that's awesome. Yeah. So how is it hanging with the judges for that long? You get to be pretty good friends, huh?
Yeah, and I got to hear stories that I had no idea ever happened. Uh-huh. It was an honor and a privilege to judge with Bobby Ingersoll and Doug and Smokey and to be around Billing for that long. But those guys were, Bobby started the Snaffle Bit Fraternity.
Uh-huh.
And so he had stories. Oh, there was never a dull moment.
I bet. What a treat.
And I learned so much. Those guys uh-huh. know more. They've forgotten more than I'll ever know.
Uh-huh. When you say you learned more, what did you learn?
Oh, just about judging and about horses. And they're just so knowledgeable.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It's in their genetic code. And so they're able to say it in a really simple way. I'm like, oh, I never thought about that before. That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a treat
it
for you.
It was really a treat. I was really honored that Bill asked me to be part of that panel.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're pretty good yourself.
Well, it's all relative.
I want you to take us back to when you were a young girl, and I want to just hear your story and how you got started. And
well, if we go all the way back, you know, there were dinosaurs roaming roaming the earth. And, no, I grew up in Rye, New York, which is a fairly affluent suburb of New York City, about 40 minutes outside. Mm-hmm. And my mother had ridden horses as a youngster and was a serious golf and tennis player. And of course wanted me to be a golf and tennis player. Mm-hmm. But it was always horses for me. Mm-hmm. I just always wanted horses, loved horses. I was about 6 when I won my first bingo contest and won $200 and wanted to buy this pinto pony named Cracker Jacks. And, you know, uh-huh. they had to do everything to prevent that from happening. But when I got to be old enough to ride and really enjoy it, they bought me a horse. And I trained it, showed it, flipped it. And then with that money was allowed to buy a better horse and did that a number of times and
oh wow
got me started. I rode 3-day event horses. Cause that's
Wait, how old were you then when you were flipping these horses?
Flipping horses, early teens. Mm-hmm. And they were mostly thoroughbreds. I rode 3-day event and, you know, the English version of the suicide. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And loved it, loved the challenge of it and just loved everything about it until mm-hmm. I got exposed to cow horses. Mm-hmm. And then it was all in the rearview mirror. I was uh-huh. just all about cattle, cow horses, everything cow.
So did you get exposed to that as you were 3-day eventing in the East?
No, I had moved to California. We had vacationed in California as a family, and the East Coast never felt like home, ever. Uh-huh. And so when I went to California on this vacation with my family, I was like, oh, this is it. This is home. So as soon as I was old enough to get out, I did. And
how old were you then?
I did 1 year of college uh-huh. on the East Coast, and then I wasn't going to do it either. So uh-huh. I moved out after that and got a job on the Tagus Ranch and got involved in cow horses and cow dogs and everything cow.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yeah, Doug Ingersoll lived down the road, like about 10 miles. Mm-hmm. And we had a really good, we had a string of quarter horses and Leobar. We had the sire Leobar, and there was one little cow horse. His name was Toonie Colorado Bar. And so I put him in training with Doug and rode my bicycle down to El Capitan where Doug was 10 miles every day after work.
Wait, you put the horse in training with Doug?
Well, the ranch did. The ranch put the horse in training with Doug and said that it couldn't interfere with my work at the ranch, but I could do it after time. So after I got done working every day, I would ride my single speed beach cruiser bicycle 10 miles down the road to El Capitan, take a lesson, ride it all the way back home in the headwinds, you know, and did that every single day. That's how bad I wanted it. So now it cracks me up when people are like, oh, you know, no, I got to go hook up my trailer to my brand new Dodge. And that's too much trouble to get down there. I'm thinking, oh, my God, I was there pedaling a one-speed bicycle down the road every afternoon to learn. I wanted it so bad.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And that was where I developed my love of the whole vaquero tradition and uh-huh. My understanding of hackamores and spade bits and just the whole tradition of training horses that way. And
are you talking about it, Doug's? It started at Doug's?
Yeah, because it was reined cow horse, yes. And that's what that whole style and method of training is based on, is the uh-huh. old vaquero tradition. And so I was reading, you know, all the books, Ed Connell, the Hackamore Reinsman, all these things. And I mean, I didn't even know what doubling a horse meant. Yeah, so it was very cool. And uh-huh. I, at the same time, we were aiming at being self-sufficient. So I learned how to braid rawhide, so I could braid reins and hackamores and learned how to make rawhide and make saddles, mm-hmm. do veterinary work. So it was really a very exciting time of my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So then where did you go after Doug? What was the next step?
Well,
you were with the ranch.
Right. I left the ranch and went to work for Tom Shelley over in San Ynez Valley mm-hmm. for a year. And that was amazing too. He's a cutting horse trainer for those of you that don't know. And, I did a lot of saddling and loping, but as he got more trust and faith in me, he would send me out to day work on different ranches on the 2-year-olds, which was great experience because though I loved cattle, I didn't really understand them. Mm-hmm. And he had a group, well, there was a group of men, Walt Mason, Jake Copas, Dean Talbert, Charlie Chapin. They were just old cowboys that just knew cattle. And at first, you know, they weren't really going for the young
girl. Yeah, the young girl coming out
on a bunch of unbroke horses, exactly. But I proved myself in a couple of very dire situations, and they decided I was okay. And after that, they took me on. They'd haul me everywhere to help them, and they taught me really about cattle, how cattle think. You know, I mean, they could bring a couple hundred head off of a really steep hill and never get out of a walk. The cattle or them. I mean, they just, the 1 inch here, the 1 inch there, seeing that one that was starting to move off. And
oh, what an awesome experience for you.
It was something else. So I was very privileged to be able to do that. I worked at the sales yard regularly, and I think that's what really, really helps make a horse, those hours, those long educational hours where you're riding a lot and training a little instead of riding a little and training a lot. And I think the horses that I made back then were, you know, they were pretty good horses. So I was there for a year, and then I went out on my own. But because I had the relationship with those old cowboys, they still would call me up and use me. So I got to spend a lot of time riding horses out.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. Because I know just from being with you, some out in California, those big California ranches are so beautiful, and they're always needing help at certain times, right? Yep. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
So you went out on your own, and then what?
Well, when I went out on my own, I had nothing. I didn't have a truck. I didn't have a trailer. I had a saddle because I made one. And I had, you know, a couple of pieces of equipment. But basically,
Sandy Collier, you are the most, just what you just said there, I made my saddle. I mean, those of you that don't know this about Sandy, she built all of her fences.
She learned how to weld because I didn't want to pay someone to fix the cattle feeders.
Yeah, exactly. And braided the reins. And so utilitarian that way.
I'm like a Swiss Army knife.
Did some vetting on or veterinarian work on some goats.
Yeah.
So
we'll save some of those stories for later. Anyway, I basically had nothing, but I had a few people that, you know, really thought that I could probably train a horse and give me horses to ride. And I gradually, you know, built up the place where I was at and built up an arsenal of equipment and went and bought an old trailer and went and bought an old truck. And pretty soon I was going down the road. And I did okay. Even the quality of horses that I was riding, which was pretty questionable, things were a little bit different back then. It was hard for women to compete successfully. So I just figured I had to stay home until I could be a couple points better so I could go win. And I did. And then I started winning. And then as I started to win a little bit, I got better and better horses and got more and more equipment.
So what year was that when you were saying that harder for women to compete?
This was back in the late 70s, early 80s. It was just it was just a little bit different. I don't think it was anything, you know, conscious, but I think that we just probably weren't as good. So I was pretty determined to become as good and maybe just a little bit better. So
exactly,
so I could be competitive, and so I did.
Well, there weren't that many women there. It was exactly the same. For me, there just weren't as many women, so you better be a little...
You better be a little better.
Yeah.
And if not, just stay home till you are.
No, I'm just... Oh, my God.
No problem.
That comment's going to come back to bite me. Oh, my gosh.
Well, for those of you that don't know Barb really well, everything is no problem.
Yes.
And that's what makes things like no problem.
You want to explain what you mean by that?
Well... You know, when we get all wrapped up thinking that everything that we're doing is so doggone important and something bad happens and we get all stressed out about it, Barb will go, hey, no problem. We'll figure out a workaround. It's no problem. And we'll look at each other and crack up. And you know what? It isn't a problem. And we figure out a workaround and it's all good. So no problem,
the
Barb.
The last clinic, though, there was a thing that we thought was going on. It was like, I'm sitting there saying, no problem. And then about 5 minutes later, I said, Sandy, I don't know how we're going to get around this. But anyway, it was solved. What we were waiting for in the mail was there, so we were rescued.
It always is solved.
It's solved one way or the other anyway.
Yeah.
So tell me a bit what your philosophy of horse training. is, was probably the same.
My philosophy evolved as I evolved. At first, I didn't have any philosophy at all. It was pretty much, you know, just try to make these horses be better horses. And I didn't really have a lot of finesse or knowledge to fall back on. But I became more, I was always wide open to learning. I just had to get the right exposure to different people. And, you know, I read a lot of books. Back then, they didn't have clinics and a lot of books. And, you know, nobody shared their secrets.
Holding things a little close to the vest.
Oh, yeah. So it was a little bit hard to learn stuff. But I have to say that probably a really big turning point in my horse training evolution was being exposed to Gerald O'Brien, who's an Australian that used to come up here to visit Hayden Upton, the horse chiropractor. And he specialized in training Liberty horses. And his big thing was creating desire in a horse to do what you want it to do. Mm-hmm. That thought had never crossed my radar screen. Like I thought you just made a horse do what you wanted it to do, and that was that. But how to create desire in a horse to do what you want it to do so that they're part of a team. And that was like, that opened up a whole new realm for me, because that meant I could have a partnership with my horse and I could, you know, be part of a team and I could have them wanting what I wanted, not as bad as I wanted it, because they'd really rather just be in the shade swatting flies, you know, any good horse would. But it did change my program quite a bit and helped me to, I can only say evolve. I evolved as a person and I evolved as a horse trainer. So, you know, for those of you that don't know what I'm talking about, it's, you know, more about making the right thing easy and the wrong thing hard and teaching a horse to be in the place where you want them to be by the release of pressure and not the application of it. And so they actually want to be in that right spot. You know, if you're, mm-hmm. I had a real eye opener because Eric Freitas was a client of mine at that point and he was a farmer and he had two cell phones and they would ring all the time. And no matter what he was doing when they'd ring, he'd stop his horse and talk on the phone for a while. Well, it got pretty soon where the phone would barely start to ring and whoop, they'd slide into a stop and stand there all relaxed because they knew the big reward was coming. They were going to get to stand there for a while. And I remember thinking, that's what Gerald was talking about. How interesting is that? Like, his horses are sliding to a stop when they hear the phone ring because of the reward after it. And I'm like, and pieces just started to kind of come together for me because of that. So that was pretty cool. And another thing of Gerald's was he would explain that there are like four stages of training a horse. And the first one was creating the desire, you know, getting the horse to be compliant, where every time you say sat down and exhaled and relaxed that they would stop because of the reward. And when that became like, no matter what was happening, when you just kind of sat down in the saddle and said, whoa, they'd stop. That's like the beginning. That's the first stage, compliance. After they do that, then you start to tell them, well, how you want them to stop, whatever your discipline is. So, you know, for the cow horse, we want them to, you know, stop on their hocks, stay soft in front, soft in the face, maybe take a step back, but use both hocks, whatever you want them to do, that's when you start teaching them. But you can't override that desire that you're trying to continue creating in them to want to do it. So if you put in too many rules too fast, pretty soon they don't want to stop. Or if you're teaching them to cow, they start looking off. They start hiding. It's too much for them. And then you got to go back and create that desire again and then start putting the rules in. And after a while, you teach them how you want them to do it and they stay hooked in wanting to do it. And then, only then, do you get to do it fast. Mm-hmm. And so that became like probably the foundation of my training once I became aware of that. And it changed my whole program. Mm-hmm.
So when you're judging, can you see that when horses walk in the pen? Like, what is it that you notice? I mean, obviously you're judging their performance. I understand that. But just what are the little things that are maybe big things that you notice that really catch your eye in that way?
That's a really good question, especially since I just got done doing that. Some of the things that really excite me when I'm judging is to see a horse that knows his job and looks like he loves it. Mm-hmm. When I see that, I'm like all over it. And so what I mean by that is, like, in the herd work, for instance, that they're cowing and they're staying correct. Mm-hmm. Like, we saw a lot of really robot type staying correct and controlling the cow, but the horse didn't look like he was engaged and cowing and happy. And then we saw other ones that were engaged and happy, but they weren't maybe as precise and accurate. But then there was a few that were both, and that mm-hmm. was like, wow. Mm-hmm. So that to me speaks volumes. And there are a few trainers that are very good at that. Mm-hmm. And so it's always really exciting to watch them.
So then trainers engaged and happy too.
Yeah. 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 You have to be happy and trust your horse, and your horse has to be happy and trust uh-huh. you to make yeah. a really good team. Mm-hmm.
I think that quality of really wanting it for the horse, wanting mm-hmm. it to be a good experience for the horse, mm-hmm. And then having the skill set to do that is yeah. really very special, because it's so easy for people to, like, want a horse to do something, you know, and just keep kind of working at it and not being connected to the horse.
Yeah. And we're on such a time schedule that sometimes that overrides, you know, that connection. We just have to make it happen. We think we have to make it happen, but it's actually not a shortcut to do that mm-hmm. ever.
Well, you might lose something in the
you do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You lose a lot in uh-huh. in that override. So, uh-huh. and you have to go back and put it all back together. It may hold together for a show. You know, if you're under a time crunch like that to force something to happen, you may get through that show, but it will come out. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Always does.
So what do you look for in a horse? Let's just go back to, like, your clients when you've had non-pros and amateurs, and looking for a horse for you to show. Mm-hmm. What did you look for?
I think for me, the most important ingredient is a big heart. And I don't mean, like, physically a big heart, but a horse that has a lot of try. Because I think when they have a lot of try, it can override a little less ability if they really want to do it. Because I've had horses that had all the ability in the world that didn't care about doing it. Mm-hmm. And they never look like they care about doing it, and they don't have that magic. And then I've had horses that didn't have as much ability that wanted it so bad mm-hmm. that they were exciting enough to watch, because they wanted to be good. They wanted to do the job. They wanted to control the cow. You could see it in their eyes and their ears and their body and no tail going on. And they kind of enrapture you. Mm-hmm. And so those kind of horses seem to make really good show horses. That, like a consistent disposition, like not a real flighty horse, but, you know, a pretty consistent disposition that, you know, they don't hold grudges and get their feelings hurt too often. Mm-hmm. I ride road mares a lot. And so, you know, mares, you have to be careful. They get their feelings hurt and they hold a grudge, and so do studs. So you have to be careful about that. But if you don't have to tiptoe around quite that much, it's nice. Mm-hmm. But it forced me to be a better trainer, because I did have a lot of mares in it, and I did have to train the individual. There was no cookie cutter type approach that I could have, because I had horses that wouldn't tolerate it. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so that was actually really good for me. And the fact that I wasn't as strong as a lot of the guys was better for me too, because I couldn't, you know, manhandle the horse. I mm-hmm. had to actually figure out how to train him. So, mm-hmm. you know, all those things worked for me, I think, in mm-hmm. the long run. It just didn't seem like it sometimes at the time. Mm-hmm.
So when you see a really beautiful horse walk in the ring with a real level look and athletic look, it catches your eye, right?
Yeah. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with really a lovely conformation and nice, bright expression, but the heart is the heart of the matter. Uh-huh. Yeah. If they uh-huh. don't have that, they can be all the beautiful they want. We see that in people. We see it in horses.
That's a really, really good point. And so how did you teach your amateurs and non-pros? Because you had a lot of amateurs and non-pros, right?
Yeah, with a big stick.
Yeah, just the way you do clinics. Yeah. I just say, come on over here, and everything will be fine. Take a break.
Count to 10. No. I've always loved teaching and sharing, and I know that in the beginning when I had a lot of non-pros, I wanted it so bad for them that I wasn't as patient and as I am now. I wanted it so bad for him. But, mm-hmm. you know, when I learned how to fly an airplane, my instructor happened to be one of those amazing people that didn't care if I put us in harm's way because he knew he could get out of it. So he let me make mistakes and let me have my own learning curve. And I learned a lot about teaching people from him, learning to fly an airplane at a later age. Because there was nothing I could do that scared him or made him get uptight or anything. He was like, he knew he could handle it. And so I was free to experiment and learn. And I wish I had had that experience before I started trying to train non-pros. But I got better as time went on and became more patient and found better ways to help them learn. Mm-hmm. And I know at our clinics, I'm much better now for having had that. But I think, you know, Greg Ward used to say, if you can make your horse 1% better a day, that in 100 days, they'll be 100% better. Mm-hmm. And if you go get greedy, try to make your horse 10% better one day, you go backwards. And I think it's the same with non-pros. If you just try to make a little improvement each day and forget about what they're paying you and that we've got the show next weekend and all that, if you can just help them get a little teeny bit better each day, mm-hmm. and a little more confident each day, that you'll actually speed the process up. Mm-hmm. Not slow it down.
Well, and I think that people are like horses in the fact that their confidence.
Yep.
You know, as a teacher and a trainer, you have to look at their face expression and their body, and you have to see when they have this confused look or nervous look or pressured look, and take them back to a place where they can relax, because as we know from working together, you can't. If they're not in a certain place, you know, mentally,
right.
They can't absorb. Same with the horse. Like, if they're not engaged, they can't. If they're too nervous or too overstimulated, they can't.
I think adrenaline is the biggest enemy of learning.
Uh-huh.
And I know that again from flying. Like, when I would get uptight, I would get in a bad situation. I couldn't retain anything. I just wanted to go pull the plane over so I can stop and figure this out. And you can't do that. You know, you really can't do it. Well, you can with a horse, but when you have adrenaline going, you just can't figure stuff out in your head.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, I think keeping people confident and calm in a learning environment, it's not the end of the world. If they mess something up on their horse, we can always fix it. So mm-hmm. we have to learn to not create so much tension in them, because we mm-hmm. want them to be good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So tell us about this plane flying thing. When did you start doing that, and why?
I don't know why. No, I do know why I started. But Eric Freitas was a pilot. He was a client and a pilot. He was the broccoli farmer that had the cell phones that taught me how to stop a horse because of that. He had a plane, and we were going and looking at horses a lot back then. And he would fly me. And I thought, if he can do that, I can do that. And that's kind of cool. And they had a plane that was a club plane at the airport in San Ynez. And I thought, I think I'm going to get my pilot's license, because that's kind of how I was. You know, if I was going to, I bought a rental house in Lompoc, and because I was going to buy a house, I thought I should get a real estate license so I could do my own deal. You know, so I did.
See, everybody, that's exactly, I need a saddle. I think I'll make
I think I'll learn how to make one. Yeah, I think I'll go get Juan Lara at Jedlicka's to teach me how to make one. Yeah. And I did.
I need to buy a place. I think I'll be a realtor.
So anyway, so I thought I'd be a pilot. So I went to ground school and learned how to fly, and meanwhile got completely off track with meteorology. Like, I'm also a learning addict. My name is Sandy Collier, and I'm a learning addict. I love to learn, and so I got all inspired about meteorology and started studying that, learning about the systems on the airplane, and got more into that, and learned how to fly. And then as soon as I got my license, I realized that I knew enough to be really dangerous. So I got just enough hours in order to be able to qualify to start my instrument rating. Got my instrument rating right after that. And I still wouldn't take anybody with me till I had my instrument rating, which is ridiculous, but that's how I was. So I got my instrument rating, and then I started, you know, taking people to go places, look at horses and whatnot. And then I wanted to be better at that. And so I came within a few hours of getting my commercial rating.
Wow.
Yeah, but with all my knee surgeries, I couldn't get in and out of the airplane anymore. So it was a problem. And I was trying to simplify my life at that point. This is like back around 2016. I was just trying to simplify everything. So one of the big things that I let go was flying.
I see. Mm-hmm. Do you miss it?
No, because, you know, the saying that flying is hours of total boredom interspersed with moments of sheer panic. It's really accurate. I mean, you can be up there for hours, and then all of a sudden you're coming into your airport and you've got traffic, you know, right and left, and you've got the air traffic controller wanting to chew you out, and the winds have just changed and the runway's changed, and so I don't miss that part of it, but it sure was convenient. Mm-hmm. And it was just another thing that I learned that I loved and loved the challenge of learning about. So
I didn't know the air traffic controllers chew you out.
Oh yeah. And if you jack things up, they'll send you out on penalty vectors. So, you know, if they don't like you, cause you're whatever reason they might not like you, they'll send you out and make you do some holding patterns out in East Africa there. And then they'll bring you in when they feel like it.
Really?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, that's the hand slap.
This now, do they do that for commercial?
No.
No. No, no, no.
No. Just the weekend flyers.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So was there a time when it was just really difficult for you, you know, that you had to overcome things? I know this is like a secret question because I know that there were lots of things that you endured, at least physically.
Yeah, I have had a lot of physical setbacks. My health has always been really good, but my joints are an orthopedic nightmare. And so I have...
No, they're a dream. They're the surgeon's dream.
Yeah, right. My nightmare. You know, I just always figured that they were just things that... They were just challenges along the way, and they were part of my journey, and I just had to figure out how to navigate and find the... What was it Ronald Reagan used to say about how the little boy that saw the manure piles and was sure there had to be a pony there, you know? Got all excited because he was looking for the pony because of all the manure. So it was a similar sort of thing. I mean, I just had a lot of stuff happen, and I just always was trying to look for the pony in the pile. Mm-hmm. And I tried to stay real positive and make good use of those layups that I had. And actually, that's how the tips from the masters happened.
Well, I think you need to share with everyone the layups, what they were, because most people probably wouldn't know.
That's probably true. So I had torn rotator cuffs on both shoulders twice each.
Wait, but did it just happen, like something happened suddenly, or over time?
Apparently, you know, they weren't that aware of the bone spurs that were causing rotator cuff tears back then. Remember those dinosaurs that were walking around back then? So mine was not diagnosed. I was given cortisone shots, which then weakened those rotator cuffs even more. Mm. So one day I was leaning two studs down the hill together to be efficient. And one went one way and one went the other as they started this fight. And I didn't want to let go of either. And so my arms
I've never heard this story before.
Yeah, so one of those rotator cuffs gave way. And so it's a painful and not fun layup. And then another time I was unloading a stud up in Idaho, and he had a fit, and I didn't want to let go and tore the other rotator cuff. And I remember, it was such a miserable show, but I made the finals, and one of the other trainers tried to give me some Mobic. Is it Mobic? Anyway, it was a medication that I didn't know anything about, and I thought he was trying to Tonya Harding me, so I didn't want to take it. I thought I'll be like, I will be walking around, I won't even know where the barn is. And anyway, I ended up winning the Idaho Futurity with, you know, a torn rotator cuff, and then I had to buy the pillows from the hotel to make the 17-hour drive home. I had to buy three pillows so that I could drive home. Anyway, so I had the rotator cuff issues, and then I had a knee replacement that didn't go right. They had to revise it, and then they had to revise it yet again, and the other knee got done too. Then I had both shoulders replaced. So over a period of from 2008 until fairly recently, seemed like it was one joint after another. And that's actually ultimately why I stopped training horses, was my orthopedist said, you know, if you want to retire with one joint in your body that's your own, now's a really good time. And I said, I think you're right.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So anyway, but that's how Tips from the Masters was born. I thought, what am I going to do for this 3-month layup? I mean, the horses were all still in training. I had good assistants helping. And so they stayed in training, but I needed something to do besides sit down in the back of the car, of the truck, and coach them. So I thought, well, I think I'll video all the guys that have, you know, won $500,000, which was a lot of money back then. Mm-hmm. At least $500,000, and give me 10-minute segments on something that they just has kind of stood the test of time, and that they teach all their non-pros, or that's really valuable. And then so I was going to do one volume. Well, 4 volumes later,
I bet then, that was fun.
Yeah.
Huh?
Then I was doing tips about bits, you know, with bit makers and veterinarians and X-rays and anatomy specialists. And I mean, there was just all, so that was, you know, I always tried to find something fun like that. And when I had my second knee revision, that was when I took that 3 months and became a life coach. Mm. So I always tried to make use of that time and find a good way to look at that time that I had, and use it for something good.
Mm-hmm. So that's been a fun thing for us to share.
Yeah.
Your background in life coaching and my performance skill training.
Yeah. I think it's really enhanced the clinics that we do.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And I know that, for those of you that don't know about Barb's, relationship with Dr. Jim Lehrer, you know, one of the things that he says is so important to have sustainable success. We've all seen major athletes that were at the top of their game fall off because of their lack of a strong personal foundation, their lack of ethics, their lack of
character.
Yeah, their why. Their why kind of got lost.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, it's just really important. A lot of, you can have success, but sustaining success, mm-hmm. You have to have a strong personal foundation, and mm-hmm. you have to have a North Star that you keep pointed at true north. And so that's what, for me, that's what life coaching is. And so your performance coaching and the life coaching kind of, I think, go hand in hand mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. creating a really sustainably successful person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. And it's been fun at the clinics when, you know, we do the judging presentation and the performance presentation and carry it through.
Yeah.
So what of the mental skills did you, I think you learned that you were doing a lot of them and you didn't realize that you were doing them.
I know.
So tell us about that.
I can't remember the year, but I started, they called it peak performance and mental toughness back then. And and there were a couple of different techniques that I learned that I was using. But there were other things that I was doing that I really wasn't aware of till we got started doing clinics. And I was like, well, I always do that. I never called it a ritual, a pre-show ritual. I just always felt like I wanted to be the one that took my horse's tail braid out, put the boots on, felt the legs, pull my horse around, do this and do that, ride in the pen, you know, just the whole show preparation part of it, and where I would get myself mentally. I didn't know like that there was actually a whole program that taught you that, but I was doing a lot of it and just didn't know. So how it was really,
how do you think you learned that?
I don't know. I mean, it was just something that I felt like I needed to do to, get in touch with my horse and get grounded and centered and be able to go in and do the best I could do, you know? And I never was competing, trying to win either. I remember Margie Suter, cause I used to start all of Gene Suter's 2-year-olds and Margie Suter way back then said, you know what, just be the best you can be on that day at that show in that arena and let the chips fall where they may. And I went, okie dokie.
That's some of the most sage advice, because people think that they have to try to win. And of course everybody wants to win, but
I didn't try to win the Snaffle Bit Futurity. I didn't dream in a million years that I ever could, but I just had a good horse and I trained her as best I could. She knew her job, I knew mine. And I just tried to show her the best I could on that day in that arena, and the stars aligned, you know. It wasn't like I was going out to mark a certain score or beat anybody or anything like that. So It was sage advice, and I've always tried to do that. And then I found out that that was all part of, you know, having your own scorecard and not competing against other people, but just trying to be your personal best. And
Well, it's pretty awesome that you held that record for so long, and pretty awesome too for Sarah.
Couldn't have been any happier. She worked for me for a while, and so it's kind of like it came full circle, and I was just sorry that I couldn't be there to support her. But I was there on the, I was there watching it on the computer.
Yelling at the computer.
Yeah,
I'm sure it is fun to watch our students do well.
And I've had a lot of assistants that have gone on and been really successful, and I can't tell you how much satisfaction that gives me, how much joy it brings me to see them do well and have success.
Well, what do you think about the horse industry? And
what do you mean about the horse industry?
Well, I just think things change over time, and I don't know. I just thought maybe you'd had a perspective about.
Yeah, I think the horse industry is changing. I think each year the horses get, they're better bred. They're bred more for the events that we're competing in. They're smarter, more able, more athletic. I mean, I this year after watching the Futurity, I thought, how much better can they get? But I remember thinking the same thing 15 years ago when I was looking at old NRHA and NCHA videos. I'm like, back then we were thinking, how much better can they be? They're going to break their hind legs off if they stop any harder. And yet, here they are. So they are getting better and better each year. And another thing that's happening right now is that there's a very significant influx of interest and money into our industry. And I think that that's really awesome and it's exciting. And I also know that there are people that are expressing concern because they don't think that they're going to be able to play because they're, you know, they have budgets, and if they can't buy horses that they can be competitive on against these higher dollar horses, then, you know, they're looking at it as the end. And I think that it's just the beginning. I like to think that the reason that people ever invented better mousetraps was because they had to. And I think that they can use this as rocket fuel. You know, they can become students of the horse. They can learn how to train better. They can maybe make lesser horses be as good or better. And they can learn different methods. And I think it's just a very exciting time. I look for a lot of innovation and people developing, you know, better and smarter techniques to stay competitive. And I think it's going to be really exciting to watch. I think it's going to require a little bit of navigating, but I think it's going to be really good.
Well, the cow horse industry is certainly thriving in terms of interest. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
You know, it really is.
Yeah. Well, it's a very exciting sport to watch. And having the three events, I think, makes it a really, really excellent spectator sport. And then having the last event be the fence work, which is so exciting. And the best of the best can just, you know, the show be over with it, you know. And you can come up from behind, you know, and really stick one on them. So it's a very exciting event. The you know, the limiting factor is that not everybody can do it. You've really got to be able to ride. And you've got to be able to have cattle. And you've got to, you know, there's a lot of things that you have to have. So it's not something more like reining that more people can do, and you don't have to have quite as much facility, and you don't have to have cattle. And, you know, there a lot of times the best horse does win because they're just being judged on the reining. When you introduce the cow into the cutting or the cow horse, that completely levels the playing field, because then any, you know, not anybody can win, but most anybody can win. And in the rein cow horse, there's two cow events. So it makes it really, really exciting, where maybe not the best horse wins, but almost everybody stands a shot at it. So it's pretty cool.
So as a trainer, is it hard to train for all those events?
I think so. I think it's because they're very different. I think the horses, you have to have a real training program. You can't teach all three events to a horse in a year and a half if you don't have a pretty solid program that where you aren't doing things differently. You know, you teach the same turnaround and, you know, the same stop and the same, you know, you have to make all of the events dovetail, I guess is the best way that I would put it, so that the horse doesn't have to learn multiple ways of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to do each one enough that the horse is confident and that they know the difference between the two. And when they get confident and they know the difference between the two, oh, we're doing this, so I'm going to stay backed up on my hocks and I'm going to read this cow. Mm-hmm. Oh, we're going down the fence. It's time to jump up there and circle. They know their job, mm-hmm. and they're confident, and they trust mm-hmm. their rider, and the rider trusts them, and they figure out the difference. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was just going to say, is that whole idea of working a cow several different ways a big challenge?
It is a challenge.
Well, and also the turnaround for the reining and the cutting is so different.
Uh-huh. And if you have a horse that has so much draw that they're really cool in the herd work, they are hard to teach to turn around.
Oh, in reining.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, you have to compromise a little bit, you know, on your bloodlines and not mm-hmm. get overly cutting where you have so much draw you can't have enough forward motion to teach them to spin. But you don't want them to have so much forward motion spinning and stuff that they can't draw on a cow. And, yeah, there's a lot to it.
I would imagine that it would be a lot in the rider's or trainer's confidence mm-hmm. that I'm working on a spin. I'm not working on, you know, like if you were worried about I'm going to mess up the cow turn by uh-huh. working on the spin, you wouldn't be doing either one well because you'd always be worried about messing up the other one. Whereas you go, this is a maneuver
right.
that we're working on.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So. If you're confident in your program and separate, you know, understanding the mechanics of doing the two mm-hmm. and how different they are, and you have a step-by-step method to teach your horse and to execute it, the horse learns the difference mm-hmm. pretty quick.
But yeah.
It's interesting that I did basically the rein cow horse of the English, you know, the 3-day eventing is just as different as the rein cow horse is in the three events that you do, the dressage, stadium jumping, and cross country jumping. And then, so then it was sort of like, I felt right at home.
Doing
the cow horse because it was uh-huh. three completely different events too.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so those cross country jumpers are pretty wild.
It's a pretty wild bunch. Yeah.
Do you think that's
going
more dangerous?
Going down the fence is pretty wild,
yeah,
too.
So I don't know.
I don't think either is more dangerous than the other.
You don't. Mm-mm. I always see those cross-country jumpers just going over those, you know, still, the word's eluding me. You know, they don't move jumps and going down into muddy water 8 feet down. Or like, oh, my gosh.
Talk about trusting your horse and your horse trusting you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Now they have those inflatable vests in case they do wreck, which is really nice.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But I think that just shows that you have this definite wild streak in you that you would like.
Yeah, I'm a crazy woman.
Oh. Well, so do you have advice that you would give to non-pros and amateurs that maybe you're struggling or just learning, or what would you tell them?
Well, I think first of all, you know, you have to really love what you're doing and be passionate about it. You have to see the challenges in it as just opportunities to grow and just stick with it. Don't take things personally. You know, if you're trying to learn something, don't get where you're feeling stupid or just because you haven't won or you can't change leads, that it's a limiting factor. It's just an opportunity to grow and get better.
Mm-hmm.
I think those kind of things, so that you keep your mental attitude, you know, and never like close your mind to learning a new way of doing something or trying something. For me at the clinics, I show people multiple ways to do, say, a spin mm-hmm. or stop, because somewhere down the line, they're going to have a horse that one method doesn't work for. And mm-hmm. if they have another tool they can whip out and try it on, that just gives you more confidence that you can actually do mm-hmm. whatever it is you need to do. So there's a lot of different ways to do things. And the more that you can learn and understand the mechanics of it so that you can try different things mm-hmm. and stay open to learning different things, I think that success is... it's almost inevitable.
Mm-hmm. It's just the journey.
Yeah.
And that's one of the coolest things about clinics, yeah. I think, is that you not only have your turn, but if you stay engaged, you'll keep seeing the different ways. Right. You'll keep learning different layers. I think that's really invaluable.
Yep.
Because you can't get all those in-depth explanations in lessons. Most of the time.
No, because it's just you and your horse. You're not seeing all these different variations that you might someday encounter. Yeah. And what you were just saying about layers, you know, that's when you first start off, you know, it's pretty crude compared to what the finished product's going to be with you and your horse. And you just keep peeling those layers and getting into it deeper and deeper and deeper. And it's just like an onion. You cry at every one of them. Just peel it off.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, I don't know if you shed tears, but
I did. I shed enough of them.
It's like, oh, is that half a point? Oh, my gosh.
I know. Oh, those half a points.
Uh-huh.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, yeah. Especially out of the finals. Yeah. That was always tough. So what do you do now in your life? What are your days composed of?
Well, I give clinics with this awesome gal named Barbara Schulte. And I give my own clinics, too. I judge, not a lot, but I try to keep a balance in my life. And I sell real estate, sell farms and ranches and actually some residential real estate in San Ynez Valley. Mm-hmm. And I love the challenge of that because it's, you know, I've already kind of learned how to sell, how to match people with a product. Mm-hmm. Like I would look, you know, when I was looking for horses for non-pros, mm-hmm. I'd look and look and look, and then I'd find the one that would fit that non-pro, and I'd say, okay, come on, we're going to go see this. Well, we can't buy the first horse we look at. No, you don't understand. I've already looked at 100 for you. This is the one. You buy it, or I'm not looking anymore. And so I learned how to do that, and now I'm just matching mostly horse properties with people, and I look and look and look, and I send them listings, but I ultimately know when I've hit the one, and I'm like, okay, hey, come on, you got to come see that this is the one. And it usually is. So it's cool.
Yeah, so that's fun for you.
Yeah, I enjoy it.
Yeah, I know. You have quite the variety in your life. It's great.
Yeah, I try to keep a balance. I get bored when I do the same thing over and over, and I'm just so grateful that I have so many things I can do now that I can't train horses because, you know, a lot of people don't have things that they can go do and earn a decent living after they're done training. So when you're training, you don't realize there's a expiration date on your training.
Yes.
You think you're going to be doing it forever.
Yes.
And you don't tend to plan ahead. Mm-hmm. So I'm really grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could have been a welder. You could have been, you could have made saddles. You could have fixed fence. Let's see, you could have flown an airplane. You could have, in that, but you chose real estate. So there you go.
I know. Followed my mother's footsteps. I just didn't do the golf thing. Actually, I did for a while.
Uh-huh.
I was a Massachusetts state champion for like the...
In golf?
Yeah, for like the 15 and under, 14 and under, I was the reserve, the runner-up. Yeah.
See, I
didn't
know that.
And tennis.
And tennis? Yeah. Wow. That's funny.
I wasn't passionate about either of them. I was just always a jock.
So who are some of your heroes in the horse world or real life? Like, who do you really look up to?
Well, I think we both have one that's the same. She's passed. But she was...
God, I just get this big lump in my throat, but go ahead.
I know. She was such an inspiration to us, for those of you that... Audrey Griffin. She was, I don't know, she was sort of a saint walking amongst us, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She's in the Cowgirl Hall of Fame. She's a Roman rider from California, beautiful woman, sought after to be photographed. But when she walked in the room, it was like an angel walked in the room. She had a glow about her, very special person.
She knew no strangers.
I know. At her funeral, everybody thought
they were her best friend.
Well, no, she's my best friend.
She's my best friend.
So she'd always go, oh, my Barbara. Oh, my Barbara. How are you, my Barbara? Oh, I'm obviously her favorite person.
I don't think so. We all thought that.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Anyway, she, you know, she never had a bad thing to say about anybody. She was always positive, and she never, like, when bad things would happen, she would just say, oh, I'm just going to give that to God. She had total faith in her journey and how things were going to work out for the best. And, you know, when she had her heart attack, she never, I know she never looked back. She never went, oh, you guys, I'm going to miss you. She just went to her Jesus and off she went.
Yes. Well, she died helping rancher, helping rancher with cattle. Yeah. Loping across the pasture. Yeah. What a way to go.
I know. That was awesome.
Who else?
Well, you know, in my life coaching, I sort of discovered, because I never really gave it any thought, that the people who, or the traits that you admire in people are traits that you have innately in yourself, but you would like more of.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I started really paying attention to those kind of things, like what is it that I really admire about people, because that's something that I want to create more of in my life. And so, you know, people that have values that I admire, that manage to pull more of them into their life, you know, those tend to be people that I admire, like mm-hmm. Audrey. Like mm-hmm. everybody loved Audrey. I would love to be someone that lit up the room when I walked in. You know, I just think that would, and I love that she never said anything bad about people. She was always very compassionate. When I had my shoulder surgery, she was the only one that thought, wow, I bet Sandy can't wash her hair. And she showed up at my house with 3 homemade meals and a bottle of shampoo, put me over my kitchen sink and washed my hair. I can't tell you how good that felt, because I was going to have to be 2 weeks without getting in the shower to wash my hair.
Wow.
That was Audrey, you know? And so it sort of motivated me to be more considerate and compassionate and try to be a better friend to the friends that I have.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Who else?
Well, Barbara, you're one of mine.
Oh.
Yeah. Because nothing's a problem. You never blame anybody for anything going haywire. You're always like, yep, you know what? We can fix that. It's no problem.
Mm-hmm.
Always positive and considerate. And those are the kind of things that I value too and want mm-hmm. more of in my life. So mm-hmm. being around you has been really helpful for me to like slow down a little bit, be more empathetic, you know, just be a better friend.
But thank you
You're
for
welcome.
That. Thank
You're welcome.
You. Thank you.
And all of those things I admire in people, the very last thing is, and they're a really good hand.
Exactly. I just did a video. It came out this past Sunday. I do these little Sunday videos.
Yeah.
You know, and I ask people who they admire, you know, to pick someone that they admire.
Yeah.
And that I bet that they rode well.
Yeah.
That, you know, they were thoughtful about people, that, you know, they went through trials. And then I said, at the end, if you ranked them, their riding ability would probably be last.
Yeah. And yet you think it's first when you're first making your list, because that's, you know, really important to you, mm-hmm. that you want to be really good and competitive and all that. But it's always the personal qualities that mm-hmm. are really what you care, what you see in a person that you admire. And then they're a good hand, too. I'll tell you who else has really been a mentor to me and that I really admire is Bill Ank, our director of judges mm-hmm. for the NRCHA. With like, he knows how to put a team together and bring you together where you all have each other's backs. You know that you're never going to get thrown under the bus. If you make a bad call, the team's going to take over and your score is going to get thrown out, and you just have the confidence that you can just go on from there. Bill's not going to be sitting there thinking, well, that dummy, I'm never going to ask her to judge again. You know that he goes, oh, she screwed that one up, you know, but she won't hold it against herself. She'll get right on with it. And he's a real educator. I know that the NCHA, it's been a little bit different. Their judging has been a little bit different in terms of, you know, coming together as a team and the educational part of it. And I admire Bill so much because he wants you to learn and be better. And he knows that by discussing things with your teammates, that you can get different perspectives and you can learn more about judging from talking to each other. And he never makes you wrong, but if you make a wrong call, he'll let you know it.
Uh-huh.
But it's not you. You weren't wrong. You just made a wrong call.
Yes, it's not because you're incapable
right.
of that.
Yeah. Right, or that you're a bad judge. You
yes.
just fell asleep at the switch, or you didn't value the degree of difficulty enough, or whatever. You know, you mm-hmm. didn't give the cuts enough credit. So if you don't, like for me, I'm a real self-regulator. When I listen to the composite score and I was low or I was really high, I'm like, oh, what did I miss? You know, or what did I overcredit? And especially with this judging panel that I just judged with, I knew that if I wasn't in that range, that I missed something or I gave too much credit to something, because I just had so much confidence in those guys' abilities. Now, I would always be reminded that you don't know how we got to that score. Like there could have been a real high and a real low and you actually were in the mix. But the composite score was always, I thought, pretty right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Bill knows he doesn't have to tell me because he knows that I kind of watch myself like a hawk and I'm very critical. But if he feels like he needs to, he does, and he does it in such a good way that you know he's got your back. You know he's not...
Yeah, he's helping you.
Yeah,
he's not
looking down on you. He's just trying to help you be the best judge you can be. And wow, he does more for the NRCHA than I think most people know.
Mm-hmm. I had the good opportunity to be with him for judging one of the Mustang events.
Oh.
And that was the first time I'd ever been around him. And I was, whoa, he's, you know, analytical and fair and all of those things.
Very, very fair. And he's always trying to make the system better. He's always trying to make his judges better. He's all about everybody getting better.
Uh-huh.
And I just really appreciate that. So I've learned a lot that way in not making people wrong, you know, and helping people learn.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So when that would happen, when you saw a run and you knew that your score was either high or low, or it seemed that way.
Yeah.
So would you go back in and ask?
Oh, sometimes I did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I was way out of whack, I'd like, Bill, what did I miss on that? And sometimes he'd go, hey, you know what? You really didn't. You were right in there. Because again, you don't know how that score got there. But there were times when I know that I didn't give enough credit or, you know, weighed something too heavily. So if my score was low, I was like, wow, you know what? I really should have plus that set of circles, you know, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And judging with the group that I did, I felt really comfortable knowing that it was probably me that was wrong.
Oh, they were probably feeling the same way, Sandy.
Yeah, well, look, you know, Andy Adams judged too, and I think he's an excellent NCHA judge, and he's a great cow horse judge. And so we would talk sometimes. He'd go, I felt like I was really kind of out of whack on that one. You know, what did you think? And we'd talk about it. And, you know, he's just so wide open, and he's all about education too. You know, he monitors for the NCHA, so he's used to just being very articulate and very detail-oriented in his judging and his explanation. So I always learn a lot judging mm-hmm. with him and really appreciate his knowledge. So
I think that one of the qualities of judging is that ability to be so present and to see what's really happening instead of expecting either something not to be good or to be really good, and to stay with each thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But the hard thing is recording it. We're all seeing the same run and staying present enough and recording it
mm-hmm.
without giving too much weight to any part of it
mm-hmm.
and then coming up with the right number. It's something that until you've done it, I don't mm-hmm. think you have the appreciation for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hear people criticize the judges. I always think,
You better come sit
Try
here,
it.
Right?
Because it's just not that easy. Like when you sit at the back gate, it's pretty easy to go, it's a 72. And it probably is, but you got to show how you got there mm-hmm. so that it reads like a book, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so people can know. So you could see your card a year later and go, I can tell you exactly how that run went.
Yeah, that's what you said at clinics when you do the judging part at clinics.
Yeah. So, yeah, we all see the same run, but how present are we to it, and how accurately do we record it, and then how well do we balance, you know, because most runs aren't all good or all bad. They're like up and down and up and down. Well, the stuff that's up, how much is that worth compared to the stuff that's substandard? How do you find that right number? And
See, that's really hard for me. Yeah. I don't judge a lot. I mean, I'm not an NCHA judge, and I do some things and I enjoy them, but it's like, man, you got to like really watch and be really objective. And
yeah, and not get emotional or attached to a certain horse or rider. It's funny because I've told you this before. I've spent my whole life trying not to be judgmental. It's been hard for me because I am really judgmental. And so I spent my whole life trying not to be judgmental and accept things for what they are. And now I'm paid to judge and be judgmental. And I just, oh my goodness, what a, paradox.
Yes. Well, I think those might be two different kinds of judging.
It is, but it's still a similar mindset where you're got the laser out.
Yeah, I know what's really going on over there. So what's in the future for you?
Well, I wish I knew. I got
You don't have a crystal ball?
I don't have a crystal ball. And I've always been kind of a forward-looking person. Like, I spend more time looking out the windshield than in the rearview mirror. Uh-huh. And so for the future, I want to be forward-looking. I'm excited about what I could possibly learn and do and be and have, and that's all exciting. But I absolutely have no idea how it'll end up looking because, you and I know we can think we're going to do this and we're going to do that and we're going to be this and we're going to be that. And then, there are other plans for us. So,
yes.
So I really have no idea how it'll look, but I'm excited about it.
Yeah. Well, Sandy, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, you're welcome, Barbara. Anytime.
It's a joy. I always learn things when I'm with you. So one of my greatest things has been, and being with you, number one, has been learning about cow horse. Like, this was really interesting. I think I'm a little, not that I'm too old that I couldn't do it and enjoy it, but, it would take, oh my gosh, I couldn't do anything else.
You did it pretty good on Elvis that day.
I did. I could do the cutting part.
Oh, yeah, you could.
But the other thing is I just admire your intelligence about so many things. You're just always a shining star.
Thanks.
Anyway, we go to Moab next week and we'll have a good time.
We do. We're doing a woman's retreat there.
Yeah.
In our favorite place.
Uh-huh. Yeah, those are great.
I got to tell a little story on myself about Moab. You can edit it if you want. The first time that Barb and I went to Moab, we were driving. It's on the Colorado River. And we're driving down, and it's the Red Rocks and
it's
the
really
national
magical
parks, and there's three national parks all right there, and the Colorado River, and it's like, I'm all like, oh, Barb, I feel like I've been here before. I'm getting all deja vu-y, woo-woo, and we get to the lodge, and we go in the lodge, and there's all these huge posters. All the John Wayne movies were shot there, Thelma and Louise. I'm like, of course I've been here a million times.
Exactly.
It was pretty funny. That's a really special area, though. I love it. And I love our retreats. They're lots of fun.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that Devin's dad,
James,
was the original guy that started the program and with some of the cow horses.
Right.
So the horses there are responsive and at least have some base. Some of them have training.
Yeah.
So we have fun with cattle.
Well, he trained out of there he went, showed at Snafflebit a few times, and that was his training facility, basically.
Oh,
and so, he was the stock contractor there, and he trained the horses pretty well. And that's why they're so much fun. We work cattle on them. We pull all these dude horses around and change leads on them. It's pretty fun.
I know. It's great. Yeah. It's really fun. Very magical.
Yep.
So, okay. Well.
Well, I thank you for doing these podcasts. I think they're fun and they're informational, and I love listening to other people tell their story. And you do a great job, Barb.
Thank you, Sandy. Sandy always surprises and inspires me. And don't miss the opportunity to ride with her if you ever get a chance. Thank you for listening. And until next time, have fun, enjoy your horse, and be kind to yourself. See you soon.
Thank you for listening to the Barbara Schulte Show. If you have enjoyed this episode, subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform Like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram to stay tuned for future episodes.